This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Welcome to episode number 257 of Literary Treks. I am Bruce Gibson. We welcome you to the official Star Trek books and comics podcast of the Trek FM network. And with me, with a cold, unfortunately, Dan Gunther is sick. Dan, I feel so bad for you.
Oh, don't worry about it. Just a cold. I couldn't let it bring me away from talking about Star Trek books and comics, and especially for today's episode, because I'm really excited about this one. So, you know, wild horses, let alone a little old cold, couldn't drag me away from this.
I can understand why, because we have author Una McCormick in our feature today, and we're going to talk about the newest Star Trek Discovery novel, The Way to the Stars. And this is a character piece about Sylvia Tilly, and she's a favorite character of a lot of people, and this novel does not disappoint.
Absolutely. I think you'll hear when we're talking to her how much I enjoyed this novel. So I'm really excited to talk to Una about it, for sure.
Absolutely. But before we do that, we have several items we want to cover in the news, and we have a comic, and we want to talk through some of the feedback we received in the Babel Conference on episode 255. So let's get to the first news item, and that is a new Discovery novel has been announced. It's Discovery, The Enterprise War. But the interesting thing about this Star Trek Discovery novel, it's about the Enterprise during this time, prior to season 2. And this is written by John Jackson Miller, and this book will come out on July 30th of 2019. So this is the fifth Discovery novel that we received. The one that we're talking about here in the feature is the fourth, so this is the next one coming in July. Dan, do you feel up to reading the summary of the book?
I think I can manage. A shattered ship, a divided crew, trapped in the infernal nightmare of conflict. Hearing of the outbreak of hostilities between the United Federation of Planets and the Klingon Empire, Captain Christopher Pike attempts to bring the USS Enterprise home to join in the fight. But in the hellish nebula known as the Pergamum, the stalwart commander instead finds an epic battle of his own, with not just the Enterprise, but her crew as the spoils of war. Lost and out of contact with Earth for an entire year, Pike and his trusted first officer, Number One, struggle to find and reunite the ship's crew, all while Science Officer Spock confronts a mystery that puts even his exceptional skills to the test, with more than their own survival possibly riding on the outcome.
I'm excited about this, but at the same time, I'm like, well, this is just a Christopher Pike novel. We've had those before. It's not really Discovery. But so we have several of the older Pike novels coming up on future episodes this year here on Literary Treks. And I was thinking today, when I read those, I might just picture Ansem Mount as Pike when I read those novels. And then this is going to fit really well into that flow of Pike novels, because it's yet again another Pike novel, but written now after Discovery has been on the air.
Yeah, and at the time of this recording, two episodes of season two have aired, so we've gotten to know Anson Mounts Pike a little bit better. And interestingly enough, John Jackson Miller on the Trek BBS has talked a bit about this novel, saying, like, you know, even for the people out there that don't really like Discovery, they can just treat this as a Christopher Pike novel. Basically, it just takes place concurrent with Discovery's first season, during which the Klingon War is happening and the Enterprise is unable to attend the war, I guess, basically. So, you know, you can treat it as, you know, this is firmly in the Discovery, you know, milieu and all that stuff. Or you can just treat it as Captain Pike and picture Jeffrey Hunter if you want. It apparently works quite well either way you want to read it.
Yeah, I approach every Star Trek novel as a Star Trek novel. I rarely really pay attention to if it says, ooh, The Next Generation or Deep Space Nine or whatever. Because, like, for example, I mean, we've had Deep Space Nine last year that was about Captain Sisko on the USS Robinson. It had nothing to do with the space station. So I kind of ignore that. Just go into it as, hey, this is going to be a Star Trek
story. Yeah, it's in that shared universe that we all know and love.
Exactly. So the next thing we have is a cover of a book that was announced previously, and it's a TOS novel written by Christopher L. Bennett. And the novel is called The Captain's Oath, and it has a picture of Kirk on the cover. I almost wanted to say in the pre-TOS uniforms, but also pre-TOS uniforms are Discovery uniforms, but they don't look like this. So it's, you know, the non-black collar uniforms.
Yeah, the where no man has gone before uniform.
Exactly, those uniforms. Or even the cage uniforms, something like that. But this novel is coming out May 28th of 2019, and I like this cover. Mm-hmm. There's some object here in the middle, some round object that the Enterprise is swishing by. I'm not quite sure what this is.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. So Christopher L. Bennett has said about this novel that it takes place earlier in James T. Kirk's career, but at a very specific point. So it's while he is the captain of a ship that he commanded before he took command of the Enterprise. And I think he said this would be kind of a destroyer type ship, like that size of ship, if you compare it to the Enterprise. So, kind of interesting, a little piece of Kirk's career that we've never seen before. And like you, I really like this cover. I like the composition. It's, you know, lately we've gotten either Photoshopped character faces or a ship or something as a cover. And this one actually is a kind of nice arrangement. We've got the character up in the top left corner and this weird alien ship thing or station or whatever this is, and the Enterprise flying past it in the foreground. I really love this cover. I think it's really gorgeous.
The fact that this takes place earlier in Kirk's career probably means we might not get the Enterprise in this book, even though the Enterprise is on the cover, or we start off in the Enterprise and it's a flashback looking earlier in his career. I'm actually excited that it's not during the 5-year mission, that it's something earlier on, because we don't necessarily explore that time period with Kirk very often. And I'm going to think, if this takes place sometime around when Discovery's taking place, I'm going to think, well, this was happening somewhere else in the galaxy while the Discovery was doing other business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So we have another cover. Oh, by the way, would you put your stamp on this one?
I would definitely give this one my stamp of approval, for sure.
I would too. So the other novel that was previously announced that is now coming out in August, August 13th, I think it was supposed to come out, what, in March or February originally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, February or March, somewhere in there.
Yeah, The Antares Maelstrom. That book is an original series book by Greg Cox. And again, we have a cover with Enterprise, but Enterprise is more front and center and bigger on this cover compared to the cover we just reviewed. And it looks like there's a bunch of some kind of unknown ships heading down towards a planet, and the Enterprise is either following them or looking to intercept them. But I love there's the stars, a very orange, yellow cloud, like vision above the planet. It's again, a beautiful cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like the colors and the arrangement on this one as well. These ships, they look kind of like, I don't know if anyone has watched Stargate SG-1 or Atlantis out there, but these kind of look like the Earth USS Daedalus type starships. A little bit. Not Daedalus class from Star Trek, Daedalus class from Stargate. So I think I'm probably just confusing everyone if you've not seen the cover now. But yeah, the interesting ships we've never seen before. And this really cool orange cloud that must be, of course, the Antares Maelstrom swirling about and looking quite menacing here. Really cool.
Yes, absolutely. So I give it my stamp of approval.
Me too, definitely.
Excellent. Well, the next thing we have in news is we have another comic series announced from IDW. And this, you don't have to wait that long for. It's coming in April of this year. And it's the original series Year 5 series of comics. So previously IDW a few years ago did a series of comics on Year 4 of TOS. Now we're getting Year 5, the end of the 5-year mission. And I mean, that's great, but we have had other novels and comics that take place in the last year of the 5-year mission, but that doesn't deter me from wanting to read more.
No, definitely. It sounds like IDW is kind of wanting to say, this is the definitive what happened in TOS Year 5. I mean, you know, that's great, but we have so many stories set there that I think Year 5 can be kind of whatever you want it to be at this point. But that said, I, of course, am going to be picking these up and reading them because new Star Trek stories, how can you go wrong with that?
Yeah, and it sounds like there's a thread that's going through these because writer Jackson Lansing says that the series will be a vital, hard-hitting, character-focused look at Captain Kirk on his last year in command, and that Kirk's actions in the series will have a huge ripple effect from the outbreak of war in the Alpha Quadrant to an unprecedented strain of trust with Spock. Will turn a mirror on modern society just as the original series did in the 1960s and boldly towards meaningful, heartfelt story. And writer Colin Kelly, another writer, says, with Year 5, we don't just want to thrill. We want to channel the power of franchise creator Gene Roddenberry's original vision to tell a story about the future that illuminates our present.
Yeah, this looks pretty cool. I like the idea that it's an ongoing series, not just kind of a one-off event thing. I'm curious how long this series will go. It doesn't sound like it's just a mini series. It sounds like it's going to be kind of an ongoing thing. So I'm curious to see where they end up with that.
Yeah, this was a story that was covered in the Hollywood Reporter. And it sounds like, yeah, right now it's an extended storyline. There is no end. So they're saying, at least to the Hollywood Reporter, saying that they feel like the series might run a bit longer than the usual 5 to 6 miniseries. So we'll have to see how long this one goes on.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's what we have in the news. And speaking of comics, we have a comic we're going to review. And oh my gosh, here we go. Star Trek versus Transformers #4. You know, this is authentic Star Trek.
Yep.
Hey, if you like TAS, the animated series, and you like Transformers, this is the thing for you. And even if you don't and you like Star Trek and or Transformers, I still think it's something for you. It's a fun read, and we've been covering these as they come out. This is a 5-issue series. This is #4, so we're nearing the end. And we pick up where we left off in the last issue, where there's this big battle going on between the different Transformers going at each other, the Decepticons and are the evil Transformers, and they're fighting a gigantic Enterprise. Yes, a gigantic USS Enterprise that has transformed into a Transformer. So picture the Enterprise as a Transformer, and Kirk is inside controlling it. And it's so funny to hear this Enterprise Transformer speaking when it's actually Kirk, but then Kirk seems to be falling into the control of Maximus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like Maximus has these feelings of vengeance and wanting to take revenge, and Kirk is kind of having to fight this and maintain his own control and sanity, I guess, you know, in control of what they're calling Fortress Tiberius instead of Fortress Maximus here. So, yeah, he's kind of throughout this issue battling that and trying to maintain control over this, you know, Goliath transformer.
I so want this transformer as a toy. I so do. If they come out with this, I'm putting money down on it because I so want this.
I had the same thought as I was reading. I don't know if I'd get it, but I would love to see it for sure.
I've never had a Transformers toy, but this I would get just so I can say I have it. Yeah, pretty awesome. And then McCoy and Spock are on this Enterprise ship. I guess trying to get to Kirk on the bridge. I don't know. There's just so much going on with these battles, and the Klingons are involved, and the Decepticons get mad at the Klingons. And then we have another Transformer here named... And remember, I'm not into Transformers, so I don't know hardly anything that I'm talking about, but Starscream is one of the Decepticons that decides, why am I even getting involved in this battle? Everybody's fighting each other. I'll go off and try to take some energy with me and learn about the cloaking device from the Klingons and take out of here. I'm going to grab some dilithium and I'm going to go conquer my own world. So see you guys. And the Decepticons are like, wait, where's he going? We got to stop him. So the Decepticons all of a sudden want to go after Starscream, and then our heroes are going to go after them because they don't want Starscream and the Decepticons to conquer the Klingon Empire, even though the Klingons are foes. But that's okay because we're Starfleet. We always protect life, no matter if they're our enemy or not.
Yeah, so the meat of this comic basically is the huge fight. And then, yeah, like you said, it kind of wraps up with them chasing down Starscream and the rest of the Decepticons who are on his tail into the Klingon Empire to prevent them taking it over. And what's kind of cool is we've got, I guess, two Enterprises racing into the Klingon Empire together to take these guys on. So I think we're going to have a pretty epic battle in the next issue by the looks of it, even more so than what we got in this issue.
Yeah, because this other Enterprise was created by these Transformers, and it is a Transformer, but it transforms back into an Enterprise. But this is a little different of an Enterprise. I mean, it looks the same inside and out, but inside things are a little off because when Kirk is sitting in the captain's chair on this, he is proportioned correctly with the chair, but there's a Transformer that was on the bridge, so the bridge is much bigger, so Kirk and his chair looks smaller. I was having a hard time in this issue with the perception of size of things as Spock and McCoy are running through the ship. Mm-hmm. We see the transporter that our crew looks small on it, like they're rinky dink. And then but the transporter is huge, so to accommodate the transformer. But then as our crew runs through the ship, everything looks the same proportion as them again. So to me, it's like it's probably not an exact duplicate of the Enterprise. There are aspects of it that accommodate our Starfleet crew, and then other aspects of it that are big to accommodate the size of the Transformers.
Yeah, they seemed a little bit more kind of loosey-goosey with the size this time around. It was a little hard to kind of get my head around it. Even towards the end, like on the bridge, some of the shots, it looks like they're just normal-sized on a normal-sized bridge. It's kind of, I don't know, it's hard to kind of figure out there.
Yeah, I thought it was hard to the point that I went back to issue 3 to see, wait, did I misremember something or did I misread something? But no, I'm just thinking that if you were walking onto this bridge, from our perspective, it might look like the regular bridge, maybe just a little wider. But if you looked up, the ceiling is like really high up. Like, so the proportions, I think, might all be off. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm thinking too hard about this.
That might be the case with regards to this comic, I think, for sure.
But it is. It's a lot of fun. And even though I'm not that familiar with Transformers, it's the animated series. You know, it's fun. If the Transformers never existed, I could see this being an episode of the animated series.
Yeah, definitely. I could see this being integrated into that world a little. It makes sense that they chose the animated series as the setting because it does seem to fit a lot better there for sure.
Absolutely. So, yeah, this is issue 4. So we have one more issue left with number 5 that will conclude this story as they take off towards Cronus or the Klingon Empire, and The Enterprise is going to try to save the Klingons from the Decepticons. So there you go. Okay, so next, before we get into our feature, let's just go take a quick gander at some of the comments we got in the Babel Conference about episode number 255, and this was the episode that we had Justin Ozer on, where we talked about the IKS Gorkon Book 3, Enemy Territory, with Keith R.A. DeCandido. So Justin gives us our first comment. Wait a second, does that qualify? He was on the episode.
Hey, yeah, that shouldn't be allowed. we'll give it to him.
Yeah, we'll give it to him. He says, thinking about the Ellabridge hammocks made me think of the scene from DS9's episode Explorers. Sisko says, let's take a break. String up the hammock. Hammock time. And Jake says, yo.
Yep, there. That is the other reference to hammocks in all of Star Trek. Good call.
Yes. So hammocks are canon for sure.
Bruce, you commented here with actually a tweet from Keith DeCandido in response to the episode, and he tweeted a picture of what could be an Ellabridge. Now, if you remember from the episode, they're described as not having heads separate from their bodies, and you know they were these kind of weird creatures with six legs that were also arms and all this stuff. And he says that the closest visual of what the Ellabridge look like is Chode from the early 2000s animated series Tripping the Rift. And I don't know how many people out there have seen that, but he's this kind of purple blob dude with kind of green dots on him and three eyes in the middle of his body and a big, huge mouth kind of across where the stomach would be. And I hadn't thought of that. I haven't thought of Tripping the Rift for many years, but that could be kind of something you might have in your mind while you're reading Enemy Territory. Makes sense.
Let me just tell you, I know more about Transformers than I know about Tripping the Rift, which means I don't really know anything about Tripping the Rift. I've looked it up. Some of the images I know I've seen somewhere before, but I've never watched this show, which looks like it's saying it's a CGI science fiction comedy show.
Yeah, it, with definitely adult sensibilities as well, I would say. It's not a kid's show, for sure. I don't remember a lot specific about it, just a lot of kind of sex jokes and that kind of thing.
Well, Keith also tweeted out about our comments on the cover, because on the cover of Enemy Unseen, it looks like it would be Leskett, and we weren't 100% sure about that, and why, if it is Leskett, why was he chosen to be on the cover? And he says, yes, that is Leskett. The answer to why he's on the cover is very prosaic. We had more photo ref of him than anyone else, so he was the easiest to paint.
And that makes sense. You know, sometimes the simplest answer is the best. There's more shots of him having been on television than the other characters. That makes sense.
You know, that sounds kind of disappointing in a way, because you'd think the answer would be like, well, the reason Leskett is on the cover is because it's a hint to something that's coming up later, or his character had a lot of influence on it. No, we just had a lot of pictures of that guy. Yeah, that's all. That's it. We just had some pictures we could reference, and we just put them on there, you know, whatever. Don't judge a book by its cover, people.
Exactly.
Although I do like the cover. I'll give my stamp of approval on this one, too.
I do like that cover. That was a really good cover, for sure. We also do have another comment by Jeff Lubin, who just says, great episode. Thanks, guys. And we learned kind of through the comment thread that he hadn't actually read the books yet. And he kind of does what I did when I first started listening to Literary Treks. I listened to a lot of the episodes about books that I hadn't read yet, which some people might not like because of spoilers. But, you know, any way you come to listen to the episode, we really do appreciate it. And if our episodes let you give you some insight into a book that you might not otherwise have picked up and then make you go and read it later, hey, so much the better. We're really happy to be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I know some people have told me that they listen to the features and listen to the whole thing, spoilers and all, just to decide if they want to read the book. And if it sounds really good, even though they've now heard the story, they go back and read it, which I totally get. There's some stories I know that I've heard and I know am familiar with, and then I still go and read the book. And actually, I think it's sometimes more enjoyable that way, because you kind of know what's coming. And so you get maybe a little more out of it if you know where it's going. So,
yeah, definitely.
And the last thing in here is AJ Black posts a link to his review of the Waypoint special number one that we covered earlier in that episode. So if anybody wants to read his review, go to the Babel Conference and click on his link and check that out. So that's really all the comments we have in the Babel Conference for episode 255. But without further ado, let's go into our feature about the latest Star Trek Discovery novel.
Oh, man, I'm excited.
Well, in today's feature, we're going to talk about a new novel based on Star Trek Discovery. And this is the fourth Discovery novel we have published out there now. And it is called The Way to the Stars. And I think it's pretty safe to say, Dan, that this is probably most people's favorite Discovery character when we talk about Sylvia Tilly as being the central character of this book.
Yeah, she's definitely up there. For me, it kind of depends who's on the screen at the moment, either her or Saru, but whenever they're on the screen, they're my favorite.
I'm kind of with you there. I'm going to throw Pike in now for this season as one of my favorites too. But this wonderful novel was written by Una McCormick, who has written other Star Trek novels, and she's joining us today. So how are you doing, Una?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. How are you guys?
I'm getting over a cold, but happy to be here and really happy to speak to you.
Thank you.
So, Una, how did you get involved in writing a Discovery novel and why Sylvia Tilly?
They asked me. I got an email saying, dear Una, would you like to do a Discovery novel about Sylvia Tilly? And of course, I practically bit the hand off the person offering it to me. So so yes, they got in touch with me. I think perhaps they had me earmarked for the Tilly book, which was lovely to think that. And obviously, I think, as you guys were just saying, for me, she was absolutely the breakout character of the of Discovery. It's just, she's just phenomenal, isn't she? I think when she's on screen, you want to be looking at her and seeing what she's doing, seeing what she's thinking. Oh no, what's she about to say? What's she going to say next?
What are your favorite aspects about Tilly?
That there's not always a filter in place, and that she comes out with what she's saying, which is often completely true, but perhaps not the most tactful thing. I think that she, all of us who watch Star Trek perhaps are a little geeky or a little, you know, not as social as we'd like to be. And I think she captures that, you know, our awkwardness, our shyness. Also, I think being smart, but not necessarily having the social graces to sort of get your point across. She's just a very, very vulnerable and very appealing character, and a lot of fun to write.
I think one of the comments I remember seeing way back when the novel was first announced, I think it was on Trek BBS, somebody said, a Sylvia Tilly novel by Una McCormick is one of those things you don't realize you need in your life until you know it exists. I thought that was perfect.
Well, good. I'm very glad we were able to supply an unknown need.
Now, this is the first Discovery novel to be concurrent with the series at this point and actually features Discovery in the book. So that's something new that we're discovering here with Discovery novels. But we also have a Goodreads group, and some of our Goodreads members had some comments or questions I would like to bring into the discussion. And this one comes from Arco. And Arco says, I am curious how the writing process for this novel compared to the writing process for your other novels.
Oh, well, this was a really easy write. I had a lot of access to scripts. And I also had two fantastic long transatlantic phone calls with Kirsten Beyer, and she and I sort of sat. It was great fun. It must be what it's like being in a writer's room, I think, on the show or on a TV show. We just sort of sat and go, oh, should we do this? And oh, can you imagine what she'd say at this point? And oh, there'd be a hat, and the hat would have tassels, and then, you know, they kind of giggle. So we had two really great sort of story breaking phone calls together, and I had a sort of constant, steady stream of scripts coming in, of rewrites and revisions and you know, more rewrites and revisions. So very close to the writer's room. But at the same time, I felt free to go with it. I felt that they had confidence in me, and that they could leave the character in safe hands. And like we were saying, we all really love Tilly and I don't want to mess it up. I want people to feel like they're reading a book about her. And hopefully that worked. So great writing process. I wrote it very quickly, which is always a good sign. That always shows me that I'm feeling confident. I remember there were some suggestions for revisions at the end and they were going, oh, will this be okay? Will this be all right? I was going, no, yeah, you know, I can get them done in a day or so. And they were, curse you for being such a great writer. But it all felt so fluid and natural that I just had a good time.
Excellent. So I'm curious where in the production of the series most of the writing was done. So, for example, did you have any access to anything from season 2 or the Short Treks episode, specifically Runaway? Did that play any role in writing this novel?
I had the script for Runaway, but I didn't have any visual material at all. So it was just scripts that I was getting. I think I was writing sort of during the summer. So things were just heading into production, I think, as I was kind of finishing up. I didn't see any visual material, but scripts were readily available. Sort of, you know, they were generous with that because they want, you know, they know that everyone likes things to kind of match up and be consistent. And part of telling a good story is having that all consistent. So I didn't see Runaway. In fact, I didn't see that until they finally arrived on Netflix in the UK the other night.
Oh man, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh yeah, that's exactly how I imagined it. So, and obviously Tilly's mother appears in that. And we talked about that character in conversation with Kirsten and in notes and so on. So hadn't seen anything, but had read quite a lot and had sort of worked with people as well.
I've been wanting to go back and watch that Short Treks episode now that I've read the book to see that scene with her mother, because I think it would be interesting to watch that now after reading the book and seeing if my perception of that relationship is different now, because we really dove into that relationship within this book. And the book starts off with Burnham and Tilly talking about Tilly's first day coming up with the command training program. And she's very scared, but she's not nervous, she mentions. And then we start to launch the story of Tilly being at the age of 16 with her mother. So tell us about that mother-daughter relationship.
Well, it's quite strained, isn't it? I think the mother is, her mother's very ambitious for her. Her mother is very ambitious and is very high achieving. And I think in her daughter, she sees someone with gifts and talents. But perhaps she's not quite seeing what those actual talents are. So she's seeing intelligence and smarts, but she wants Tilly to go down a certain direction. And Tilly really wants to go a different way. But where Tilly is at the start of the book, she can't really articulate that to herself. It's sort of a joke in a way that she likes these strange old mushrooms. You know, there's not really a way for Tilly to articulate that, no, actually what I'm interested in is patterns and connections and grand unified theories of science and physics and so on. So Tilly's quite young and her mother's very experienced, very knowledgeable, very, very clever. And it when you've got someone like that in your life, it's quite hard to sort of push against them. It's just difficult to say no. And I think that's what Tilly has to learn during the course of the book, is to say, actually, no, this isn't what I want to do. It's like Jake Sisko having to say, no, do you know what? I don't want to go into Starfleet. So that break that children have to make and adolescents have to make, where they say, well, no, I've got to start finding my own way here, even if it means disappointment or displeasure.
Are there any aspects of your youth that you put into this book or into the relationship or character?
I like Tilly, I'm a scientific genius that is unrecognized. No, nothing like that. I think there's lots that you put in. You have to speak from emotional truth whenever you're writing anything. So I remember being at a convent school and being the only one interested in science fiction and this kind of thing. So you remember having interests that other people quite don't get. I remember sort of going to a sixth form and finding people who liked Doctor Who, and suddenly I'd found my team, my fam, as they'd say now in Doctor Who. I'd found my tribe. So you remember those emotions and you try to put that in. Of course, now I'm writing this book and I've got a little girl. I didn't want Tilly's mother to seem a monster. It doesn't work like that. That's not a good story. People aren't like that. I wanted her mother to feel ambitious for Tilly, maybe not very good at listening to Tilly or being so clever that she sees mistakes that Tilly's going to make, and so she tries to impose her own will. So I don't want people to hate Tilly's mother. I want them to sort of understand where she's coming from and just see that, sometimes these relationships do break down, that you have to make a break with someone before you can have an adult relationship with them. So, lots of bits of me, but into many of the characters, I think.
I think in a lot of ways that relationship is something that a lot of people can relate to. I mean, maybe not to the extent sometimes that the relationship Tilly has with her mother, but, we all feel alienated from our parents and, sometimes that they want to control. And then as you get older, that relationship flips around. So I think there's a lot here for readers to grab onto and recognize in themselves and the people around them.
Good. I'm glad about that. I'm really pleased about that. Yes. So, So I hope it's not as simple as Tilly's mother bad, Tilly's father good. Because, of course, he's sort of wandered off. He's been off the scene. He's sort of, they've kind of all agreed that he can go off on this research trip. But really, in their hearts, I think they all probably knew it wasn't best for Tilly, as it turns out not to be. So there's complications, I hope. And yes, I hope it's something that people can sort of go, yeah, I can remember what it was like to just be annoyed by my parents.
Yeah, actually, I just had lunch with my parents and I'm 51 years old and there's still aspects of them that still annoy me.
Quite right. They're doing their job in that case.
That's right. But now it's interesting that the show has established, as you were working through the scripts and closer to the writers, that Tilly has this relationship with her mother, and then you wrote that relationship with her father, which seems to be better. But as you said, he's off, in the distance, he's traveling. Mm-hmm. But you decided to start her in the book with her grandparents. So I was just curious why you decided to start at that point with her, with a good, healthy relationship with her grandparents.
Yeah, she gets on well with her grandmother, doesn't she? I think it's probably easier being a grandparent because you can have sort of all the fun of interacting with the child without really the permission or the responsibility of having to be the one that says no, or you must do this, or you must do that. So I think the guys back in the writers' room had quite a clear sense of who Tilly's mother was. She's quite a sort of high-ranking Federation diplomat. So we imagined that she would probably be quite distant a lot of the time, that she wouldn't necessarily be there. There'd be other people picking up the childcare. And that once Tilly's father goes off, then it sort of falls to the grandmother to do a lot of this care. I mean, Tilly's sort of 16, so, she's, a lot of that is taking care of herself. It's mostly just, making sure she's in the right place at the right time. And, she's doing her homework anyway, because she's that kind of kid. So, I thought it was interesting to sort of put her with her. The other good thing about having characters like that is that you've got a couple of characters that you can sort of have sitting back going, well, if only these two would listen to us. And, they're kind of like a Greek chorus, or they're your anchor point as a reader for someone else's perspective on this quite intense relationship. It's a third and fourth pair of eyes going, oh, if only Tilly could not be so highly strung, if only her mother would just stop and listen, and these kinds of things. So it's a good anchor for the reader to have different eyes on this relationship, I think. Also, they were good fun. They were good fun. Grandparents are always good fun. Yeah.
I loved the perspective of her grandmother's partner, and like when, she goes to war, basically, he's like, uh-oh. these he's women like, in this family.
Yeah,
I'm
just going to sit in the next room, maybe with a book, and if I hear actual screaming or knives being drawn, then perhaps I'll intervene or something. But yeah, mostly let me just keep my head down. Yeah, he was a lot of fun to write. So and again, I think he's that one step even further removed, isn't he? Because he's not actually related to any of them other than by marriage. He can just observe these sort of three generations of extremely strong-minded women making his life interesting, not boring, but slightly complicated. Yeah. He was good fun.
Okay, well, then we see that Tilly is now sent to a new school by her mother, and now she has to try to fit in and relate to other students, but it's a school that's getting her ready for the diplomatic corps, and she doesn't want to go that path. So everybody's wanting to go a different path and be diplomats, and she wants to be more of a scientist or an engineer or something along those lines. And so she has a hard time. I feel like she does a good job in a way of trying to fit in and get along with the other students, but not quite feeling like she belongs. And she does form an engineering club, which seems fantastic because she's found a small group of her own. But then her mother kind of guilts her into dropping that club and leaving it. So I was wondering if you could talk about this point in her life and dealing with friends in school.
Oh, it's all just her best, isn't it? It's like she, whichever decision she makes, somebody will be unhappy. So, you know, setting up the engineering club, her mother doesn't like it because it's stealing time from other things. Dropping it, her teachers are disappointed because they can see it's good for her. And then also it takes her away from the set of people who probably would be her. You know, they'd be the people that she'd go and play Settlers of Catan with or something, you know. and instead she's ended up with a really nice set of people. But they're just not really very interested in the kinds of things she's interested in. They're interested in different things. And that's okay. You know, it's fine to be interested in different things, but it's not fine if you're trying to make yourself pretend that you're happy with that you're doing things that you not really want to be doing. So I think poor old Tilly is just she's caught between everyone's demands on her, isn't she? She's trying to do things, she's trying to fit in, she's trying to make friends, and she's making mistakes and being pressured into decisions that aren't good, and it all just gets too much for her. She just goes, right, I've had it, I'm off. I'm done. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't all quite, she doesn't quite pull everything together. She's got this big presentation that she works far too hard at, and then it doesn't go right on the day. Her boating club, you know, it's not quite what her mother wants her to be doing because she's not really exercising, but she's learning about teamwork and captaincy, in fact, as well, of course. But they come in second, yeah. So she doesn't quite come away with gold. So she feels she's failed at everything. She hasn't really, you know, her teacher again is an externalized saying this has actually been a great start. She's, you know, trying to do too much and maybe she should be doing more of the things that she likes, but it's actually been a great start. But Tilly feels she's failed. And I think when you're at that age, failure feels almost like it's going to annihilate you because you're still quite fragile. Your sense of self is still quite fragile, that if something goes wrong, you think it's the end of the world. And in fact, it's only the secret, of course, being a grown up is that when things go wrong, you still feel like it's the end of the world, but you kind of pick yourself up a bit more quickly. But Tilly hasn't had those experiences. It's always been success. So failure or not quite doing as well as she would like is really devastating. And that's why she sort of chooses to run away. That's what she does next. Let's get out of here. Start again.
Yeah, and that's interesting because it really plays back to that very first part of the book where she's worried about the command training program. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, she's grown up, but she still has that worry of failing.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I think this is very common for high achievers. I taught for a long time at a prestigious world-class university, and I sort of taught undergraduates there, and the fear of failure was very, very strong. They'd never really failed. But also the sense of competition was very strong. You were always surrounded, I think, by someone who is slightly smarter or doing slightly better or slightly more glamorous or, you know, all these kinds of things. And I think Tilly and many teenagers feel those kinds of pressures. Yeah, so it's a tricky old time for her.
Well, there was a comment earlier from Arco in our Goodreads group, and Arco had another comment related to this and was wondering if you did some research into behavior of highly intelligent children and the way Tilly reacts to classmates, to homework assignments, and makes plans is very typical for children with a high IQ.
I'm one of these writers that doesn't set out to do research like that. I'm one of these writers who's always watching wherever I am. I'm just sort of observing human behavior. So I guess I wouldn't call it research, but I have, because I taught at university for a long time. I'm often around young people who are very anxious about grades, very anxious about doing well, very anxious about not getting things right. So I've spent, I'm well into my 40s now. I've been teaching in universities for over 20 years. I've spent a lot of time around young people who are quite worried in that way. And I was one myself once upon a time. So that would be my research. Not, I didn't sort of set out to do it, but I've observed quite a lot of this. And I taught students from lots of different backgrounds. So I taught engineering students for a long time, taught them sociology for my sins. So I've sort of observed lots and lots of different types of kind of kids and the way that they learn, or the way that they cope with the stress of exams and school and so forth and so on, and performing well. So that's my research. Nothing sort of concrete, but just a long time around that kind of those kinds of people.
You know, this is very helpful for me because my daughter is 17 years old. Mm. She'll be going to university in about a year and a half from now. So we're just going to those early phases of looking at schools and applying. And she's a straight A student, yet she worries constantly. She's mm-hmm. constantly stressed. And I'm like, why are you worrying? She's like, oh, no school's going to take me. I'll never make it. I'm going to fail. And I'm like, you're a straight A student. Why would a school not want you? But it's like what you're saying. It's like they're not used to failing and they're just always trying to succeed, that they're so afraid of failure that they get so stressed about it.
Yeah, and it's really, really hard. And it's sort of, a couple of years ago, I decided I was going to take up hobbies and be really bad at them because I thought it was a really good experience for me. So I took up sewing. I was terrible at it. It took me about 3 years to make a dress. And, it was really awful. But I just really, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed doing something that made me stop and think and have to go back to basic principles and think, okay, well, how do I switch this flipping machine on? I'm not very mechanical either. I'm very sort of spent a lot of time in my own head. So doing something that was quite physical and, had to be quite dexterous with, I thought it's really good for me. I took up running as well. I'm terrible at it. I'm really slow and hopeless and all these sorts of things. But it's quite a good experience to be bad at things because it sort of relaxes you. You don't feel like you need to be good. You can just spend your time in the moment. But it's so tough for these kids, you've got to work hard. It's really exhausting. I wouldn't like to be a teenager now, I think. Really tiring. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
One thing I noticed with Tilly is her, laser-like focus when she's, on something. So her big final project, for example, she's just focused on that to mm-hmm. The detriment of everything else in her life, pretty much. And then even when she runs away, she's not really seeing the ripple effects that this is having. It's just, her and her mother, and she's very focused on that sort of thing. And I found that to be very, it makes a lot of sense, like seeing people like that, and especially young people, mm-hmm. how they don't tend to look at the bigger picture and realize that, on one side, these smaller things might not be the end of the world, but at the same time also not realizing the effect that their actions might have on the rest of the world. I thought that was a really interesting aspect.
Oh, good. Yeah. You're completely right about her laser focus. And of course, this is what makes her so good. This is what makes her that absolute attention and being able to sort of absorb yourself in a problem or an idea to get to a really sort of deep understanding of it is what makes her brilliant. But yes, it means that she forgets things around it. It's really sad as you watch her working on that project and see what a bad effect it's having on her relationship with her roommates. And hopefully when you're reading it, you as the reader are going, oh, Tilly, stop it. You're going to, mm-hmm. she's going to move out. She's not going to take this. You're being really unkind. There's a bit where she kind of moves all her stuff onto one side of the room, kind of shoves the mess and then her roommate moves out and you think, oh no, I'm writing it going, oh, Tilly, I wish I could just sort of intervene and stop you. Well, I could, of course, I'm the writer, but I won't. I've got another 50,000 words of book to write. So yes, she's the focus sort of drifts. And I think smart people do this sometimes, maybe it's a joke about absent-minded professors or something, but I think you do really, really focus. I know my other half and I often go, we probably ought to have something to eat round about this point, oughtn't we? Because we've both been absorbed in what we're doing and, forget how late it's got or how busy we've been. And, there are other things to do. So, yeah, it's what makes her gifted and talented. but it's not always to her benefit. And she needs this group of people around her to go have a cup of tea, or, you know, go and have a sandwich, you know, or maybe you should take a little break now, Tilly. And I think this is what she has to learn to do, to take care of herself and to sort of be part of a team is one of the big things she has to learn.
Yeah, that was a tough part to read, because at various points in my life, I've kind of been on both sides of that, where I treated a roommate kind of like that. And then I had somebody who was on, you know, even higher level than me and treated me like that. And I was like, oh, I see that. Oh, that was brutal.
Oh, yeah. It was quite hard to write those bits. Yeah. It's so painful. I think it's those are what it's funny, isn't it? It's like it's like noisy neighbors or something, isn't it? They're sort of the people that you wouldn't necessarily spend much time with. And yet they have this huge impact on your life, and noise intervention, those kinds of things, they can really wind you up. You know, they really, it's like something's tick, tick, ticking away. So, oh, good. I'm glad I threw up all those horrible memories. Good.
So, you know, it's funny too, because I think about that whole relationship with her roommate and the other students to the point now that she has run away. And as a runaway and the experiences that she went through, it seemed as that was the opportunity for her to, as you say, fail, but also to succeed and really discover what she is and who she is and what she is meant to do. I mean, I loved seeing that growth from school to being a runaway. I don't encourage children or adults even to run away, but it was a good lesson for her.
It really is. And of course, in a book, you could sort of, what a book or a story is doing is saying, well, you know, the emotional journey that you have to make is a break. And in the story, we do this through the sort of, you know, the metaphor of being a runaway. So yes, she genuinely has to look after herself. I think one thing we haven't mentioned is of course that her mother is so high powered that immediately there's a massive security alert, and she's sort of trying to dodge this whilst at the same time on some level knows that all she has to do is effectively pick up the phone and say, could somebody come and pick me up, please? So she knows there's a backdrop there, and that's part of what's frustrating her. She makes some terrible mistakes straight away. You know, she gets her bag pinched and her ID and all her money and everything. So she's really sort of, she has to make a choice though. Okay, will I now just hit the panic button, or will I try and press through here? And on the whole, I think she acquits herself pretty well. She sort of gets by, and by the time she does go back home, or where she's found, she's found herself a job. She's done pretty well. Started to make a friend. Haven't they arranged to meet for a drink or something? So she's really finding a way. She's actually done pretty well. But then, of course, reality bites, and a child of somebody that high powered couldn't remain a runaway that long because they're a security risk. So if somebody found her, then, you know, it would be in trouble. So the Federation were always going to get her back. But she's done all right. You know, she from that, she can sort of take away, well, actually, I probably could do this. You know, I won't leave my bags unattended again. You know, I won't make stupid mistakes like that. But I've done all right. I've done okay. So it's really, really important for her. It's a really good good experience for her, if a bit scary.
I love the kind of cast of characters she meets on this kind of journey of hers. And, you know, finds herself in, I think, fairly real danger a few times, maybe not even realizing how close she was, but at the same time, kind of cultivating these strange allies that you wouldn't expect along the way, just through the force of her personality and the kind of person she is.
Yeah, and because, like we've said, we all find her a really appealing person. And I think that people meeting her would find her appealing, as well as irritating and, you know, needs to shut up, all these sorts of things. So that, you know, everybody finds that thing. I think what I sort of wanted in the book is I wanted her to be presented with a series of sort of mentors or potential role models. And she could sort of, that happens as you go through life. I think you meet people, and they don't necessarily say to you, young Padawan, now I shall be your mentor. But you sort of have encounters with people. You go, well, actually, I found you really admirable, or you really helped me, or you look like the sort of grown-up I would like to be. And I wanted her to meet a set of people like that. And then, you're also, as you're growing up, you meet people who are just awful or not particularly interested or invested in you. So she meets a few like that as well. But I did want her to sort of meet, kind of a set of people who would provide her with insight to a world beyond that relationship with her mother, that there are different ways of living in the world and there are different kinds of relationships she can have. And hopefully they're quite good fun people as well. So I liked Sala. She was good fun to write, the ship's engineer. So she was nice. that was sort of my idea, that she would meet a set of people who would give her a different view on the world and a different way of leading her life.
One thing I thought was a little interesting and a little strange at the same time is Sylvia Tilly decides that she wants to be called by her last name of Tilly, which is such an appropriate name for this character. Mm-hmm. But it's not just from her friends and the people she meets, but then she insists that her family call her Tilly, which has got to be awkward to call someone in your family by the same last name you have. And I was just wondering why, what was the thought behind that? Is that her announcing her independence and trying to show her family that she is different and she's not the same person she was before?
Yeah, I think she sort of, I think it pops out or it sort of pops out of her mouth while she's at school. I think she sort of, maybe there are lots of pet names that she's had. So she started to associate her name with being a child. So she said, well, call me this. And then once she's kind of said, I want this, she's got to kind of stick to it, I think. So her dad goes, all right, well, we'll do that if you like. But, you know, if in general, we could assume that when the captain asks for Tilly, it's for me, that would be helpful. It's not always the case, of course, you know. So,
and I like how he calls her Tills after a while.
Tills, yeah, because he's sort of going, I think he knows that it's kind of daft. So he finds a way to a nickname as well. But I think she was sick of things like Sills or Silly Billy or these kinds of things. So she sort of asserts her own name. And then kind of has to follow through in a way. But yeah, her dad finds a way around it. And her mum sort of tries to, you know, kind of force her way through it. And of course, that doesn't work, that backfires. So she has to find a different way through, I think. Yeah.
That part actually really resonated for me. Not quite to the same extent as, you know, going by your last name or whatever, but I remember when I was in high school, I became a ski instructor and I'd always gone by Daniel my entire life up to that point. And they were doing the name tag for my ski instructor jacket. And they said, oh, what do you want on there? Dan, Daniel. And I was like, Dan. And I was just Dan for the rest of my life from then that point on. And it really felt like Daniel was the kid's name. And I'm like, no, I'm Dan now, you know, and it just, so that really clicked with me. I was like, I get that. That's really cool.
Good. That really happens, I think. Yeah, my other half sort of he would sort of introduce himself as Matthew, and then immediately people would just shorten it to Matt. And he, why? I just kind of go to why do people do this? It's not your name. I don't know. They just do it. So so I think you really have to. It really matters choosing the name that you want and having people respect that as well. I mean, I just spend my life getting Uma, Una, Yuna. You know, it's never right. So but it matters. It matters that people paid attention and have listened when you said, this is my name. This is who I am. So good. I'm glad that worked. Good.
Yeah, I kind of go through a similar thing where I am called by my middle name. That was something my parents decided since the day I was born. So I'm always having to correct people when they see my name written down and it's not Richard. I go by Bruce, which is my middle name. And what's really funny is when I was 12 years old, my friends called me Brucey Baby for a couple of years and that went away. And now 40 years later, my boss all of a sudden started calling me Brucey Baby. So names sometimes are recycled and come back.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, I want to stay on the subject of names, but get off the topic of this book. I've really enjoyed how number one in the novels has been called Una. I think you appreciate that too?
I obviously, I see myself in a much more of an admiral's role, or perhaps Federation president. But I will accept that as tribute.
Well, we're waiting to see if we get a name for number one in the Discovery series. At the time of this recording, we haven't gotten that yet. So maybe it's Una, maybe it's something else, or maybe we don't know. That's what I say, too.
Absolutely.
Now we see Tilly get exposed to Starfleet as she's on the starship Dorothy Garrett with her father. And she starts to look at Starfleet, and we're seeing it through Tilly's eyes as she's discovering things about Starfleet and starts to recognize that this is something that she might fit well into. And of course, we know she eventually does join Starfleet. So tell us about that aspect of her character.
So the idea that we had was that sort of she was very suspicious of Starfleet because it had taken her father away. He'd kind of gone off for this long mission. And so she just thought of it as something that took her father away. You know, she didn't have much time for it. So maybe she had a perception of it as, you know, old uniforms and salutes and this kind of thing. Thought it was all a bit weird. Probably her mother is maybe saying, "Oh, you know, Starfleet," because they've annoyed her at some council session or something. So she doesn't have a great view of it. I think it's really interesting because all we see of the Federation through the TV shows is through the eyes of Starfleet. But ordinary people, you know, unless you had a family member, you might not necessarily know very much about them. If you're just an ordinary person living in the Federation, you don't necessarily on a daily basis know someone in the military or know somebody who's an explorer or these kinds of things. So her only perception of it is through the organization that has persuaded her dad to go away for 2 years, basically. So she's not very, very fond of them. So when she winds up on the ship, what she finds is that I think in the book she sort of starts to think of it as a giant science high school science club. She's on a ship with a lot of kind of sort of archaeologists and social scientists and a band of engineers that she starts working with. And so they're quite open-minded. They're interested in new ideas. I have them sort of run regular research seminars. So she finds a kind of bunch of curious, open-minded, intelligent people who are not all sort of saluting and, you know, clicking their boot heels together and this kind of thing. So I think she sees an aspect of Starfleet that's exactly up her street. Something that would give her a kind of framework to be able to do the kind of research that she wants. And then on top of that, she sort of gets involved in the front line of something that makes her see how it does make a difference, that her dad isn't just poking around with ruins, that being out there in these ships can bring them into first contact situations. So they'll suddenly go from being academics into sort of people involved in the front line of diplomacy. So it's all a very interesting experience for her. And she sees very different aspects of Starfleet as a result of being on the ship.
Yeah, and the ship that she's on is the Dorothy Garrett, which we mentioned. And she was a English archaeologist, and this is a science vessel. So I can see that also, since her father is an archaeologist type.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly that. Yeah, mm-hmm. she was one of these great. I think she's one of the she's one of the first women to hold a professorial chair at a university in Britain. I think she might have been the first woman to hold a chair at Cambridge, actually, before women could actually get degrees at Cambridge. So she's a pretty amazing woman. She kind of goes off on on digs in the 20s and 30s. So I thought, well, I don't want a science vessel. They're not kind of biochemists or, they're not sort of engineers. They're archaeologists and people interested in language and linguistics. So let's pick someone like that. She was also at my Cambridge College, which is Newnham College. So I like to sort of name things after, female scientists, and she seemed a natural choice. So yeah, she's on the Dorothy Garrett, which does sound like David Gerald. So I know that, but it's Dorothy Garrett. So that's why I picked it. And so it's a slightly different type of science that she's seeing, or type of sort of curiosity that she's seeing. It's not her mathsy, engineeringy, physicsy interests. But she's seen that kind of curiosity and enthusiasm for people who are experts in their field.
As a little aside with the Dorothy Garrod too, I really liked the t-shirts that they wore. You know, on Discovery we have the Disco, but for this vessel it's the Dottie, which I thought that was brilliant.
Thank you. That's one of those things that you're just sitting there and you write it down and you go, God, I'm good.
Absolutely.
Well, I had a good chuckle with that. I just had a lot of fun with that. It just pops out and you go, yes, that's perfect. I'm having that.
Excellent. Yeah, that brought a smile to my face because good. People always wonder, you know, what does the Enterprises say? I mean, it could say the Big E for all, you know, like it's just the exactly. nickname. I like it.
Good.
Well, speaking of amazing women, I really love the captain of the Dorothy Garrod, this Aussie captain, Yindi Holden. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the inspiration for her and how that character came about, because I think she's a lot of fun. I really liked her.
Good, good. I'm really glad about that. Well, I have a fantastic PhD student, and she's Indigenous Australian. And a lot of what we talk about is about issues of representation in fiction and television and science fiction and fantasy in particular, which are things that we're both interested in. Miserable it can be just to be reading a book. There's never anyone who's a little bit like you. You're always not quite involved. So I thought, okay, right, I need a captain for this ship. Why don't I make this captain Indigenous Australian? So let's have the first Indigenous Australian Starfleet captain. And there she is. So I just really like Australian people. I find them very frank. I find them very funny. It's good, massive generalizations, of course, but I'm sure there are many dreadful Australian people as well. But I feel them really open. There's no, British people can be a bit reserved or a bit, there's no nonsense. Very energetic, very can do. So I wanted to capture that sort of aspect of Australian culture and society, which I find very admirable. And Yindi's like that. She's sort of, she's very can do. She's got a lot of energy. She's very smart. She's very good at what she does. But she's also a very good captain. She's got her eye on, how Tilly's presence is going to affect Ian's work. So she sort of cooks up an arrangement for that. So she's very sharp on the kind of psychodynamics or of her crew as well. So she's keeping an eye on that aspect. And again, I thought it would be it's another one of these role models that Tilly gets to see. She's sort of, this is not what she imagined a Starfleet captain would be like, somebody very energetic and can do, quite young as well. And also a great, really good in her field. So, in her old field, Yindi sort of publishes and is very well respected. So, again, it's a kind of mentor or role model. And I love the bits where it turns out that Yindi's been in contact with her grandmother, and they've immediately got on like a house on fire, because they're very kind of frank women who are sort of very confident and just get on with things. So I like this idea that people sort of make connections because they feel they have a duty of care and kindness to someone who's in their charge. So I liked that friendship, and I'm very fond of Yindi. I hope we can see her again. It would be lovely if we could.
Yeah, you can make that happen, maybe in another book.
So. I'd like to. Yeah, she's there now. That's the main thing. Yeah.
Well, also, poor communication seems to be at the heart of Tilly's problems with her parents and those around her. And her mother never really listens to what Tilly wants. And Tilly is now under the impression that she made her father leave when she doesn't talk to him about the issue at the very end of the novel. And I mean, I think this is something that kids carry a lot of burden on themselves, thinking they've caused problems with their parents or other people. And I felt bad for Tilly for waiting for such a long time to express this feeling that she had and the thoughts that she had about breaking up her parents and carrying on that burden that was her fault when it really wasn't.
Oh, no, absolutely not her fault. No, but she's sort of so young when it's happening. And you're absolutely right. I think kids just go, well, was it something I did? And when you're very little, I think you just as part of your psychological developments, you think that things you do have a much bigger effect than than actually they do. So, of course, she's not the reason why her parents split up, and Ian sort of explains that very carefully to her in the end. But, of course, she's small enough that she's so small, she's so young that she comes to that conclusion and never really voices it, never really shakes it. And I think that probably contributes to a lot of her sort of uncertainty about herself and her need to placate both parents to keep them happy. So another reason why she takes a long time to say no to her mother, I think. So it's really tough. She's sort of very little when they split and takes it on herself and doesn't really realise until she's much older, well, actually, no, that isn't. Of course, that isn't what happened. But if you've learnt it very young, you sort of take it as bedrock, don't you? It becomes part of foundational of your personality, I think. Yeah, so poor Tilly, it's sort of, you know, Ian feels awful when he sort of realises. I think, oh my, you know, never realised you'd sort of thought that. Of course not. And then explains very clearly how it wasn't and never was her fault. So, yeah, good. I'm glad that touched. It really should do.
And I love how it took until adulthood for that to be resolved too, because, you know, a lot of people tend to, you know, separate young people from adults, and there's just this magical line you cross when all those misgivings and all those missteps, yeah, just, you know, oh, you're an adult now it's fine. But those really carry through. And I love that Burnham is the one to kind of give her a push and say, are you sure that's what happened? Maybe you should ask him.
Yeah. You know, I think that's very perceptive. Good. Thank you. Yes, I think that's something right. And actually what happens with adults is that you still have all these sort of anxieties and hang-ups, but you just get to be too tired to sort of angst about them anymore, I think. So I think someone like Burnham, who's a completely external eye and has only known Tilly as an adult, it has the kind of authority to say, you should think about this again. And I'm telling you as a friend and as an adult friend, you know, two grown-ups to each other. Doesn't sound to me that that's what it was. That sounds like the child that you were saying something. So yeah, but Burnham's not in the book very much, but it's quite a pivotal conversation, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I can speak for Dan and say that we both really loved this book. Definitely. Is it right that I say that, Dan?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. This was actually, I have to say, my fiance, who's never read a Star Trek novel, heard me talking about this and wants to pick it up because she loves Tilly, and she heard me raving about it. So it might be somebody's first Star Trek novel.
That would be incredible. That's wonderful. I really like the idea that someone could pick up this book and think, oh, that's just a really good story about a girl coming of age and growing up to be a woman. Also, it's got spaceships, which are cool. it'd be great if she enjoyed it. And of course, she loves Tilly. Who could not love Tilly? Everybody loves Tilly. So
exactly.
Yeah.
There's been times at the dinner table I was talking about the book as I was reading through it, and my daughters were asking me all these questions. You know, well, what did she do, Dad? And what, you know, because they could relate to her. And I thought, maybe this is the one book I finally can get them to read that's Star Trek.
Oh, I'll try it on them. That would be perfect, because you said one of your daughters is 17 as well. So she's sort of the same, yes, age, isn't she? Yeah. So, yeah, who knows? She might enjoy it. So, that'd be wonderful. I'd love to think that. I'm really pleased to think that this is a sort of story of a girl growing to become a woman masquerading as a Star Trek book. I'd kind of really enjoy that idea. But it's also a Star Trek book as well, I hope, very much. It's about, you know, feeling curious and adventurous and wanting to be in space and do all those sort of exciting, cool things that we all wanted to do and see when we were watching Star Trek when we were kids. So I hope it feels Star Trek-y as well as being a coming-of-age story.
Also, I could be wrong, but I think it might be the first Star Trek novel with a Harry Potter reference in it.
Yes!
Which was brilliant.
I told my daughter about that and she freaked out.
Was that the School for Wizards bit?
Yes.
Yeah, where she was talking about boarding schools.
See, you know, it could be.
Right.
Don't get me sued.
It's not direct, but, you know, it could be. Yes, exactly. So
exactly that. It'd be nice to think both Harry Potter and Earthsea survive that long, I think. That would be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
That would be
absolutely. that was the coolest aspect to me. It was, I was like, ooh, somebody in the 23rd century could be reading, you know, the Philosopher's Stone. That's amazing.
Well, no reason why not. No reason. There's probably somebody doing their PhD on it.
On
a starship somewhere.
Probably. Well, and I mentioned the Goodreads group. Daniel in our group did have one question I wanted to end the interview and the discussion with. He said that before you became a publisher of Star Trek, what other Star Trek novels most influenced you? And if you were on stranded on a deserted island, what three books would you take?
Right. Okay. Well, obviously, I was very influenced by Andrew Robinson's Stitch in Time. Because I've, as your listeners may know, I've written a lot of sort of Cardassian books, so that's extremely well thumbed. So probably that one. I think, and I'm blanking on which one it is now. One of Vonda McIntyre's novelizations of the movies, because I loved movie novelizations, because I think those were the books, things, other novelizations, sort of E.T. and War Games. I think they taught me that there were scenes happening that I hadn't seen on screen and therefore made me a fan fiction writer that turned into this career. And I loved the next gen paperbacks as they were coming out, the books by Jean Laura that I really, really enjoyed. So I was kind of reading them as a teenager as they were coming out. So those would be the Star Trek ones. Books I would take with me on a desert island, Lord of the Rings, obviously, although I have got that memorized, so probably I'd need to take it. Three, am I allowed three? Three books. Mm-hmm. Three, yeah, books. Three. Okay, I'd take that. I would take, I'd have to take some Ursula Le Guin. Let me have a little think about which one. That's tricky. Probably Always Coming Home. And then I would take T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. So that would be my three books.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? That sounds really nice, actually, if you could arrange for that. That would be lovely.
It does sound nice, doesn't it?
Very, very peaceful.
Well, when you're not on a deserted island, where can people find you online? And do you have any projects coming up too?
Oh, yes. What am I doing? I'm doing lots of things. I don't think any of them have been announced yet, so I can't mention them. But I feel like I'm literally working all the time. the big thing I'm working on at the moment actually is a collection of essays. There's a science fiction writer called Lois McMaster Bujold. She writes brilliant sort of military science fiction with a twist and some great fantasy novels as well. And I've been editing a collection of essays about her. So that's the thing I'm really, really, really focused on at the moment, because the manuscript's due in a few weeks. So we're all sort of, we've had 2 years to do it. We're going, oh yeah, we've got ages. And then all of a sudden you've got 2 minutes. It's like all these projects. No, it's actually really exciting. We're getting all the essays in. But other stuff I think hasn't been announced yet. Oh yes, I have a novella coming out in May, which is in a universe all of my own. So that's called The Undefeated. That's been published by Tor.com. And that was lovely because I pitched it to an editor called Marco Palmieri, who people might remember was the editor of the Star Trek books a long time ago. So it was Marco and I got to work again on this. It's very exciting. So that's finally coming out. And I've just had a Doctor Who novel out as well. So if people are interested in Doctor Who, the 13th Doctor, that's called Molten Heart, and that just came out. So it's been quite a busy year, and lots more things to come as well. And if people want to find me, I'm on Twitter. My disguise there is not a very good one. I am at Una McCormack.
I'm writing that down so I don't forget.
Yeah. So it slipped your mind very easily.
Well, again, I mean, we love Tilly. We love this book. And I don't want to take any more of your time because I want you to get back to writing, because we want to read the next thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Back to writing. So that's all I do. That's all I do. but yes, I'm working on a novel at the moment. No, I'm not working on a novel at the moment, but I usually am. And yeah, it'll be fun when let's see what the next thing is. Hopefully it's good fun.
I'm sure.
Awesome. Well, we can't wait. Yeah.
Thank you.
I always love talking with Una McCormick, her insights into, you know, writing these novels and stuff. And with Una, it's usually a story about Cardassia and Cardassians and that sort of thing. So it was kind of nice to be able to switch gears and do a really different type of novel with her. And I think you and I are both on the same page here. We loved this novel. So what a fun discussion. That was really cool.
Yeah, I found it a bit refreshing going into this because I love Una's work, but you're right. A lot of it has been centered lately on Cardassians. And so this seems so different for her when we're focusing on a character like Tilly. This is no way is connected to Cardassians. And so this isn't as big of an epic society look at Cardassians. It's about this character and her growing pains, basically. And it was a very nice, pleasant, fun, enjoyable read. And I can't, if anybody likes Discovery and if anybody certainly likes Tilly, this is a must read.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. Una's ability to just really dig into the meat of the character and find out what makes her tick. Reading this book has really given me a lot more insight into Tilly, and watching her in season 2 of Discovery, having that knowledge from the book just adds that much more to the character. So I think that's the best thing to come out of this book for sure.
Absolutely. And there's one thing I forgot to ask Una, because in the book it mentions on the Dorothy Garrett that there is a holodeck.
Yes.
I just kind of wanted to hear what she said to that, because we kind of saw something like holographic deck type situation on Discovery.
Which we know exists at this time, you know, from the animated series or shortly after this time. But I don't think we've ever seen like interacting with solid matter or anything like that. So, you know, I don't know.
It referred to as a holodeck.
Even. Yeah, the terminology was a little bit, I'd be curious to see about that. I forgot to ask about that as well.
Yes. Well, it's fun talking about holodecks in the 23rd century, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Meta Treks.
Wow, I had no idea that was possible. It's this ongoing link that exists between Michael Burnham and Sarek because of this mind meld that he had with her when she was a child.
Mike, I'm going to give you a Radio Shack joke because I know you and I both have Radio Shack experience. If this episode happened in the 1990s, they would have had prepaid long-distance mind meld cards.
To the journey!
But I do have a question. Why was Neelix focusing on classic American cuisine as a marketable job skill in going back to the Alpha Quadrant? Why classic American cuisine? Why not Chinese, Japanese, or Vulcan? Come on.
I think that the culinary tastes will continue to degrade for the next 3 or 4 centuries. And by the 24th century, it'll only be classic American that's left. You know, all other cuisine will have gone by the wayside.
So pot roast, pot pie, apple pie.
Yeah, every restaurant is Taco Bell, essentially. Yeah, it's the Demolition Man problem.
That's disgusting.
Literary Treks.
I think we could not do this novel without inviting a special guest, Amy Nelson. Amy, how are you doing?
Hi, I am so excited. Imzadi, Riker, Troy, it is the best. I am so grateful, honored, pleased that you even thought of me for coming on Literary Trek. So thank you so, so much.
Yeah, we're like, do you think there's anybody on the network that would like to talk about Deanna Troi?
I think I have corner on the market on that one.
Standard orbit.
Vulcans are not incapable of showing emotion, but apparently they are incapable of lying. Quote unquote.
That's their reputation. I mean, who told you? Vulcans tell you that? Of course they would. I mean, that's their reputation, you know.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And we'd love it if you'd leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, though, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, YouTube, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron on the network through Patreon. Join patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And you'll get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, so we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. And as you heard earlier in the show, we'd love to share your comments from the Babel Conference here on the episode as well. And if you got a picture of yourself in a Dottie t-shirt, we'd love to see that too. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Literary Treks, and that'll come right to us. And you can also find the network on Twitter, at TrekFM, and on Facebook, at facebook.com/TrekFM.
Find us on our Goodreads group, where we have bookshelves with all of our previously covered books, as well as the currently reading section, so you know what is coming up for future shows. Plus, there's great conversations happening about the books and comics. We had a conversation about The Way to the Stars and some of those comments and questions we just asked to Una McCormick in the feature. So just search for Literary Treks on Goodreads and click Join Group. And we'd like to thank Norman C. Lau, Ken Tripp, Greg Rozier, Brandon Shea Mutala, Justin Ozer, and Jeffrey Harlan for their support of the Trek FM network and being associate producers for Literary Treks as well. So Dan, where you're not running away from school and all those people you thought were your friends, so you can just go and discover yourself, where can people find you?
Well, luckily I'm not the son of a high up Federation diplomat. So, you know, I might be able to get a little further than Tilly did, but when I'm not doing that, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kertrats. That's K-E-R-T-R-A-T-S. You can find me on youtube.com/Kertrats Productions, where I make videos about Star Trek, mostly these days about new episodes of Star Trek Discovery. And of course, you can find me in the Babel Conference and on facebook.com/Kertrats Productions. Now, Bruce, when you're not organizing games of Settlers of Catan with your engineering club, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me in the chess club if I'm not in the engineering club. And you can also find me online on Twitter at Admiral_Rex. And you can find me here on the network doing Live from the Edge with Brandy Jacola. Or Jacula, whatever she wants to pronounce it as, which I also
or
learned.
Yakula.
Yakula. Yeah, that's the correct pronunciation, people. Yakula. Just telling you, she confirmed that on the show. Live from the Edge, we talk about Star Trek Discovery the night after premieres. It's live on YouTube, and so it's Friday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And I also talk Star Wars on the Star Wars Report podcast. And of course, I'm always in the Babel Conference. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next time.
Live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.